Hello, I'm Julia Zweig. I'm talking to you today from Washington, D.C., where I'm a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Hello, I'm Matias Spector, talking from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where I am an assistant professor at the Getulio Vargas Foundation.
Well, Matias and I were asked by the Blogging Heads crowd to get together today and talk about Brazil, Brazilian foreign policy, U.S.-Brazil relations, Brazil in the world, in Latin America, and it's an appropriate moment to do so because, Matias, you'll be going tomorrow to attend the inauguration of President Dilma Rousseff in Brasilia. What do you expect to find there, and what can we expect from Brazil in the next during her term?
Hi, Julia. Excellent. This is a very exciting moment for Brazil, not only because Dilma is the first female to be elected president, but also because in the past, say, 15 years, Brazil has undergone huge social transformation, enormous economic transformation as well. So if you put the two together, this is really quite exciting. What we can expect is an awful lot of debate about how to turn Brazil into a middle-class country. This is President Dilma's big challenge. This is what she set herself up as a big goal, and the problem is there are no easy answers on how to get there. So very exciting indeed.
Matias, during the campaign, you know, there was some speculation that foreign policy was going to become a big issue in the campaign. With a couple of exceptions, it didn't really become so. But this issue that you put your finger on, how does Brazil become a truly middle-class country, having moved 30 million people into the middle and lower middle class in the last 8 years, what are the kind of key issues she's going to have on her plate in order to do what Lula did and Cardoso started for the rest of the Brazilians who are still not quite making it into the, you know, where that middle class action is? And what kind of domestic opposition, if any, will there be? I mean, there's a pretty strong consensus in Brazil, is there not, that that is the domestic agenda for the country, whomever was to take the presidency?
Absolutely, I think you're right. The domestic constituencies are changing quite fast because now there is a mass of the population that have greater voice than they did before. And they are now the largest chunk of voters that have a new range of interests that simply were not there before. So in that sense, President Dilma will have to cope with that part of the population. We also have traditional constituencies in Brazil, from industrialists to people on the left of the party to people on the right of the party. We have the financial sector, which is incredibly powerful because all of the economic structures are premised on the back of economic stability, low inflation, and a pace of growth that she'll have to keep up if she wants to sort of emulate the past 8 years, where President Lula benefited greatly from a rather benign global economic environment. Now, in terms of the opposition, I think we are going to find opposition as we go, as the years go on, partly because the opposition still holds on to two very powerful states, but also because, as we know, the minute she starts governing, lots of voices within and without will start screaming and shouting.
Well, that sounds like a pretty familiar political environment to me. There's a pretty complex political coalition that she has in the Congress in Brazil. And just to pursue this domestic question, you know, there's some speculation that although the PT has a stronger majority in both houses of Congress than Lula had, just doing the politics of keeping the coalition together is going to involve so much horse trading that that, you know, this would be daunting to any extremely skilled politician. I mean, the screaming that you're anticipating, that's going to have to do with rents from petroleum. It's going to have to do with, you know, where's the real rub going to come from? Or is it just entrenched interests wanting a piece of the action and nothing more?
I think that it's both. I mean, they're not mutually exclusive in any way. The interesting question, I think, it is that now the big issues of how to govern Brazil and where should Brazil be going although there is fundamental consensus on the assumption that, you know, we need to turn this into a middle-class country, there's no consensus at all on how to get there. And what do we do once we get there? And that's why foreign policy is so interesting. Even if foreign policy didn't come up on the election trail big time, the big issues of where Brazil fits in the world, how should Brazil behave internationally now that it has far more power and influence than it did in the past, that's a big open question, again, within the governing party, but across society as well. And this is what I wanted to ask you. What do you think is the perception in the US? I mean, the past few months leading up to the election were months where the relationship with the world became ever more challenging. Brazil became interested in the Middle East, and it was quite active in the Middle East on the Iran file. Brazil also has been very active in trade negotiations, in trying to reform the United Nations. Brazil will take a seat, will preside over the Security Council in the UN come February. What's the perception in D.C.?
Well, I mean, you know, there's the perception ranges. You know, there's a strong cohort of people, I would say, in the administration and in the Congress who, let's say, almost nobody in this town, this company town, really understands or is knowledgeable about Brazil. So you have to start from that point of departure. And then
do you think that's a, sorry to interrupt just there, but do you think that's positive for Brazil in general? Or does that complicate Brazil's life? Because it's not clear to me that that's necessarily a bad thing.
No, but it cuts both ways, Matthias. I mean, we've talked about this. On the one hand, Brazil has this big tabula rasa, right? There's no domestic constituency for or against Brazil in the United States, and that's very favorable to a country which, as you've talked about, understands the value of flying below the American radar screen. And Brazil, of course, doesn't see itself as only a Latin American country and has so many more interests beyond the region that it is pursuing on the global front. But that is what I was saying about Brazil is not understood, not known in the United States because of where Brazil is physically located in South America. Because Brazil shares a border with 10 countries in South America, most people thinking about Brazil or asked to or forced to think about Brazil who don't know anything about the country see it first as foremost as a Latin American country. And from there descends an enormous number of misinterpretations, expectations in a kind of Monroe Doctrine way that Brazil is going to defer to the United States, as historically the rest of Latin America has, follow the United States on major international security issues or at the UN, as most of the rest of Latin America has, with some, you know, fits and starts differentiating itself, and act generally as, you know, in alliance with and in consort with the United States. So that expectation derives from this lack of knowledge, and I would say that that lack of knowledge and that expectation in particular issues, such as the episode that we had with nobody understanding what Brazil was doing with respect to Iran, was very negative at the end for Brazil because there was no baseline from which to understand what drove Brazil to pursue a role in the Middle East and specifically on the Iran issue over the course of 2010.
Sure. It's interesting you should say that, because if we look at the way Brazil's interacted with the U.S. across history, you know, the two dominant themes have been either distancing or moderated distancing.
Quite the continuum.
The periods where Brazil understood that its own interest was in following the United States, in jumping on the American bandwagon, have been really quite exceptional. I mean, we have a shortage period during World War II and then in the early 60s after the military coup. But otherwise, the argument has never been in place in Brazil that it is in Brazil's interest to follow too directly. So deferring to the United States has never been understood as a clever option, actually. I mean, if we go to Mexico or Argentina, or Chile for that matter, you find those sort of arguments in Colombia as well, even in Venezuela. Whereas that's nowhere in Brazil. So that helps explain, I think, the big divide between the way people understand the world when they're sitting in Brasilia and when they're sitting in the United States.
Well, so let's talk for a second about the how people understand the world sitting in Brasilia, for example. When Brazilians today and going forward on January 2nd, when the new foreign minister, Antonio Patriota, who was ambassador here in Washington, when he takes up his role as Dilma Rousseff's foreign minister, how will he and how will her government see the United States in Brazil's foreign policy cosmology? Where a priority, less a priority by comparison to what other powers, how important, how does Brazil see the United States? And not only in terms of on its foreign policy agenda, but how does this Brasilia, this new government, see the United States in terms of where the country itself is going, our own domestic agenda? You know, we in the United States talk about and have opinions about Brazil and many other countries' domestic agendas. We are very free to criticize what's going well, what's going wrong, and what others should do. But what is the view and what is the critique of the United States in Brasilia?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the dominant view in Brasilia is that international order as we know it has many, many problems. That world order after, say, the end of the Cold War, if you want, is problematic on many levels. The United States cannot run the world alone. It is not the indispensable nation, although it's a critical nation. I mean, one of the interesting things about the WikiLeaks on Brazil, in particular, is the degree to which they show Brazilian officials recognizing that there is no way global order that's beneficial for Brazil can function without having an engaged United States. And I think that's a very important value. But the point is, the US is not the only nation to run the show. And if you're sitting in Brasilia, the way you see the world, I think, is there's a number of emerging powers that are challenging some of the dominant norms, the rules of the game, if you want. And it's in the interest of the United States to bring these countries into running the world, if you want, because running the world alone is no longer an option. Now,
Can I just stop you right there? You know, that description that you just laid out, that's not all that different than the way smart, rational thinking people in Washington see things internationally. I mean, it's very few people that I know who actually would say with a straight face that the United States can get anything done by itself that's important globally. There are patently a number of very important powers in the world that have to be taken into account, that, you know, the word partnership is thrown around a lot. A lot of, you could say that maybe when some in the administration use that word, they mean really fake partnership. They haven't really come to grips with what that would mean to actually incorporate these new powers into the table. But I think
But here's the rub. Yeah. Even if the two sides agree that if you want to manage international order today, you need to form coalitions to solve the many problems that beset the world, there's huge disagreement about how you go about it. The perception in DC, I think, is very much that for these emerging countries to partake of managing global order, they need to become what many people call responsible stakeholders.
The Bob Zelig term to describe China, of course.
The Bob Zelig term to describe China, the Bill Clinton term to describe Brazil and where Brazil should fit. And the problem is that defining what responsible means, it's not easy at all. Take the example of Iran. Earlier this year, Brazil and Turkey put forward a proposal to bring Iran back to the negotiating table. That action produced an awful lot of strain in the relationship between Brazil and the United States. Both Brazil and the United States were saying the only way to deal with Iran is to have the international community together acting responsibly. Brazil thought it was acting responsibly. that was not the opinion of many in DC. So even if there is general agreement on the issue that now Brazil matters on a number of issues and it needs to be brought on board, how you do that is not easy. It's not clear. Take the case of Honduras. Both the United States and Brazil have been arguing over Honduras, and both of them are saying that what they're doing, and what they're doing is very different, is defending democracy. So both embrace the value of democracy. There's no question about that. And yet, when it comes to implementation, bang, you have lots of disagreement. I don't know how to solve that. And one of the things you said is quite interesting, because what you said is there's no constituency in the US for Brazil. By the same token, there's no constituency in Brazil for the United States. And the problem with that, I think, is that at the end of the day, there are no channels for communication other than the relationships between the two foreign ministries. And while that is perhaps the most traditional and possibly the most useful way to go about it, because the relationship between the two countries is so complex nowadays, because there are so many intersecting interests on both sides, either the two countries get their act together and get to know each other better, or I think we're bound to find even more friction on a number of issues in the next few years.
Well, I mean, look at it. I think the process of establishing channels outside of the two foreign ministries is going to take a long time. You know, Brazil, for you're the historian of the two of us. You have looked at the history of Brazilian foreign policy and written eloquently about the very recent chapter that Brazil is now in terms of looking outward, not just within its own region and globally. And so the desirability of having a number of open channels into Washington, it's complicated, it's ambivalent. And likewise, Washington has not seen Brazil as a likely partner, and the two countries are physically very distant from one another. The Brazilian economy, although large, booming, and hugely important, is not as large, booming, and hugely important as that of China, for example. So priority-wise, the connectivity beyond those official realms just is beginning now. And here, I think, you know, although in the kind of realm of the grand strategy discussions, putting together an uber overarching strategic dialogue between the two countries and between the executive branches of both governments might be appealing, was something that was started under George Bush. It hasn't really been continued. Are you there, Matthias?
Yeah, oh, okay. I'm here.
That hasn't continued, but what is beginning to grow is this kind of ground-up connectivity. I think if we jump ahead 10 years from now and assume that Brazilian companies, global companies will be investing increasingly in the United States and vice versa, and we see this growing Brazilian middle class, which is increasingly connected to the United States. You know, I know this sounds kind of trivial, but it's a great data point Tom Shannon, the American ambassador in Washington, has referenced before. The Brazilian middle class now is coming to Disneyland in droves on vacation.
Sure.
And I'm sure it won't be long until, and I hope it won't be long until, Brazilians are coming to American universities and vice versa. You know, we don't speak one another's language. Portuguese is difficult. Yeah. It's not Spanish. Brazilians speak English much more than Americans speak Portuguese. There are some kind of natural impediments to that kind of easy flow that I think both of us agree would help break down some of the kind of official and formal barriers of misperception and historic barriers of misperception.
Sure.
It's going to take a while.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think a useful analogy there might be India and the case of India-U.S. relations. What you just described, lots of societal distance, if you want, two societies that know very little about each other, that are miles away from one another, where interaction historically has been incredibly low, that can change quite dramatically. I'm not saying anyway
that
Brazil will
follow India in that sense. But all I'm saying is, you know, I mean,
I
do think
the language barrier isn't to be diminished. We didn't face that so much with India,
but you know, one of the reasons that
over 1.5 million Brazilians living in the United States, and many of them don't have the vote yet because they've just arrived or they're first generation. But within the next 15 to 20 years, that is bound to change.
Yeah.
I agree that's a small constituency, but if you look at what happened with Indian Americans, that's really quite remarkable. One of the things that has allowed New Delhi and Washington to begin to do business together, and their relationship has always been very strained, is precisely the fact that interdependence between the two societies has gone up very quickly, very fast. Now, while not saying that that's going to happen in the case of Brazil, I think we're going to see change that's faster than we expect, or at least that's what I hope.
Let me ask you a little bit, or let's talk together about Latin America. You know, we started off saying that Brazil has interests that are far beyond Latin America, and that's confusing to Americans. But in Latin America, I mean, one of the things I do perceive is that since Washington really has, in the last 10, 15 years, you know, that set two basic priorities for Latin America and beyond that focused well beyond this region. Those two priorities have been controversial. One of them has been liberalizing trade agreements. The other one has been drugs, counter-narcotics, the drug war. But in Latin America, since the end of the Cold War, really the United States has chosen to focus on other things. And, you know, this is probably positive in many ways for Latin America, but into that breach, Washington has left, Brazil is beginning to step. And I'm really interested, because I think it's just unfolding now, how much will all of Brazil's 10 Latin American neighbors, even the Central Americans, Mexico, the Caribbeans, to what extent will Brazil have the kind of leadership, which is a word that Itamaraty, the foreign ministry in Brazil, doesn't like, be seen as a kind of natural leader by the rest of the region?
Okay, no, that's a great question. There was a piece of research by Latino Barometro published recently that showed that for many Latin American countries, Brazil is as important or ever more important, and it's bound to be more important than the United States. I'm not sure that's the case, but you have an important point there. After 9/11, when President Bush could afford to pay attention to Latin America and had to focus his attention elsewhere, at that time, we see Brazil beginning to widen its range of initiatives in Latin America in general and South America in particular. So Brazil is now, on many respects, a regional power, no doubt about that.
It's a regional economic power. It's a regional financial power. To what extent is it a regional diplomatic power?
Well, I think in many respects, you need Brazil if you want stability, at least in South America. I mean, Brazil's become the largest sponsor of regional integration in South America. It's also provided leadership, even if that's not a word many people feel comfortable with. But the problem with leadership is that, as Andy Harwell puts it, you need followership.
Well, that's what I was asking you about. Let's stop at the integration question for just a second. You know, you asked me how is Brazil perceived by Washington. I mean, one of the things that Washington has expressed misunderstanding about and frustration about is that even as the United States has its relationship with Venezuela and Chavez has deteriorated over the last 10 years. Over the last 8 years or so, the Brazil-Venezuela relationship, in a sense, has deepened, at least its commercial and financial relationship. Brazil has sponsored Venezuela's accession into Mercosur, the South American trade community of nations. That has been controversial for some in Brazil, but Brazil, as I think we've talked about, has a kind of pan-ideological approach to South American countries. There doesn't pick fights over ideology and politics with its neighbors. Rather, has sought a strategy of pulling Venezuela into a South American integrative institution.
Sure.
Do you think that will continue under President-elect Rousseff or President Rousseff?
I think that's quite interesting because President Rousseff takes over at a time when things in Venezuela are becoming ever more difficult for the government in place and for the population, indeed. I think Brazil's attitude towards Chavez in the past several years, and I'm not speaking only about Lula, I mean going back to this latter part of the Cardoso administration, has been quite simple. You'd rather have Venezuela inside the tent spitting out than have Chavez outside the tent spitting in. Now, there are problems with that model, because to bring him in, you need to ensure that he won't break the rules and norms and institutions that make regional integration possible. Problem is, regional integration has become so difficult in South America for all sorts of reasons that many people argue it's simply not feasible to bring Chavez in and to expect anything like UNASUR or MERCOSUR, the big regional agreements, to keep functioning well. That said, I think the important point to bring up is to say there's something about Brazil's regional power dump, if you want, that makes it very different from, say, Turkey or South Africa or China. Brazil has been very reluctant to build deep regional institutions. It's been incredibly reluctant to concede sovereignty, even on soft aspects, such as cattle vaccination, if you want. That, I think, is bound to change, not because Brazil feels so secure and comfortable that's happy to let go, but because economic integration with neighbors has become so big that there's no way you can manage the regional economy without very deep levels of intergovernmental cooperation. And that, I think, is bound to produce lots of noise and friction with neighbors. So my own take would be to say, in the next few years, as Brazil becomes more powerful, foreign relations are going to be more complicated, not less.
Do you think...
With this, what I wanted to ask you was...
You're not letting me interrupt you very much.
Okay,
go ahead. What do you want to ask me? It's fine.
I just wanted to ask, one of the things I find quite fascinating is the ability of the United States and Brazil to cooperate in Latin America. I mean, the best example, perhaps, is 1995, when Ecuador and Peru go to war. I mean, peace between the two is very much a produce of American-Brazilian cooperation. But coming forward, coming to the president, the one area where Brazil and the United States cooperate is Africa, not Latin America. And I was wondering whether you reckon Cuba and transformation in Cuba today, where Brazil and the United States have very different priorities and understandings of what's going on, whether that might be a case, potentially, for cooperation between the two.
Well, I mean, you know, when you were talking about 1995, I thought to myself, well, that's 15 years ago. And in fact, when you think about the recent crises, as you mentioned, in Latin America, there's been very little cooperation. I go back to Plan Colombia in Colombia, the United States did its usual kind of ham-handed approach to consulting before rolling out Plan Colombia. But when it did consult and look to Brazil for some kind of participation with supporting the Plan Colombia basic goal of containing the insurgency and reducing drug trafficking and coca cultivation, the answer from Brazil was no. Now, that's changed a lot in the last couple of years as Brazil has become itself vulnerable to cocaine trafficking and become a big consuming country itself. But, you know, explicit cooperation with the United States on these hard security issues since 1995, I mean, they're few and far between. Brazil, for its own reasons, is acting as a mediator and a conflict resolver of crises and is getting involved in dealing with drug trafficking for its own set of interests, but not necessarily because it's something the United States asks it to do. I say that all as a prelude because the you know, the transformation underway in Cuba right now is very fundamental. Raul Castro has announced in recent months and is going to pursue now an agenda of profound economic reform. And it is going to be very rough for some Cubans, but the idea is to open up the private sector, to unleash the productivity that has been suppressed for a very long time, to actually create wealth, allow people to accumulate property and profit. A very different social order is going to begin to emerge, and it will be called socialism, and it will still have a feeling of revolution for as long as Fidel and his brother Raul are alive. But
sure.
The cooperation aspect, it sounds very kind of pie in the sky to me in terms of U.S.-Brazil cooperation. You know, what brings that home to me is when I was in Cuba over the summer and spent several days, as you know, with Fidel Castro. And right after I left, Raul Castro made a very, very important set of announcements laying out these economic reforms. Within about 3 seconds flat, Celso Amorim was in Havana with a letter from President Lula to Raul, laying out Brazil's disposition to help in technical and other financial means to make that adjustment as possible and as stable as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
What was the United States doing? Pretty much ignoring the whole thing. If you could say that cooperation between the Brazil and Cuba is Brazil and Washington thanking its lucky stars that Brazil is there, knowing, in fact, that in the absence of a serious policy towards Cuba, countries like Brazil, Mexico, Spain, Germany, the UK, China, the rest of the world is there and will help stabilize this transformation. That is as much as you're going to get in terms of informal, non-explicit but implicit cooperation. And I think it's maybe a decent metaphor, Matthias, for how things may go in the region between the United States and Latin America, as you say, and Cuba, excuse me. As you say, in Africa, they're cooperating quite directly in Mozambique on ethanol, on development, in capacity building in various Lusophone countries. But in Latin America, I think it's too fraught. It's fraught for Brazil to look at all like it's doing the American bidding, and it's fraught for the United States to explicitly cede space, not to cede sovereignty, but to cede the space that it once inhabited. I mean, so we may have a kind
of... But what about Honduras?
Well,
I mean, what about Honduras? Now we have a situation where Honduras is still outside the framework of the OAS, very much due to lack of agreement between the United States and Brazil.
Well,
how do you see that evolving?
You know, Brazil has taken a stand that, you know, that the United States regards as an obstacle now toward the president, toward Lobo and Honduras's full integration back into the region. But I think that the United States sees that as very Brazilian. You know, I mean, Brazil is living up to expectations in that sense. And so, you know, there's a kind of realistic, if not, you know, irritated sense that, well, that's you know, Brazil is expected to stand on ceremony and principle on an issue like this, especially in directly in what is the only now American backyard, right? But the point that I wanted to make, hang on a second, that cooperation might be kind of parallel play. You know, the United States and Brazil, by dint of being themselves, create space for the other to assert the other's interests. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Okay, no,
so, well, no, I'm just trying to...
I mean, neither Brazil nor the United States is going to be able to get one or the other to proceed as it wishes. And so, Brazil can stand on ceremony and have what it views as a principled position with respect to Honduras, and that develops its own bona fides and credibility should there be another coup in Latin America that the United States winds up supporting.
Sure. Is this a bad situation, though?
I mean, I, I mean, here I wear my historian's hat as well. I don't necessarily see it as a bad situation. I see it as a natural evolution of how these two powers with very specific histories and identities and very, you know, kind of similar mindsets of exceptionalism are expressing themselves in the region, right? It isn't only American exceptionalism that we're seeing at work. We're seeing Brazilian exceptionalism as well. We've heard the two of us, Brazilian officials, talk about Brazil having earned the right now to tell its story abroad and to be seen as a model to emulate abroad, including with Iran itself. Brazil's story of having had a secret nuclear program, having modernized, become a democracy, and given up that secret nuclear program, joined the NPT. That's a kind of storyline that I think some in Brazil thought Iran might emulate and saw Brazil projecting itself into the Iran scenarios potentially helpful in that direction.
Sure. So are we saying then that two stories of exceptionalism may well lead to some low-level friction, if you want, at times,
definitely. But
also create a situation where possibly there's room for diplomacy ad hoc, and that this is not necessarily bad for the region?
That is an excellent summary, and I have to just turn the light on because the light keeps changing in this room. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Go on.
There we go. That's better.
Right.
So that's what
Shall
we're saying.
No, go on.
No, go on.
No, I was wondering, if that's the situation in the region, could we now shift and go to a different region where both Brazil and the United States have an interest, although very different interests, and the asymmetry of interest is huge, and that's the Middle East. What do you think has been the effect of Brazil's behavior towards Iran in Washington, D.C. And I mean, I think the notion of Brazilian exceptionalism, which you developed so well in your Foreign Affairs piece, it's quite phenomenal. And it goes a long way in explaining why Brazil engaged Iran that way. I was wondering, what's the impact of that in the United States?
Well, you know, I think there's a short-term impact and maybe a long-term impact. The short-term impact, as you know, was that despite a year-long series of conversations and communications between the two governments about Iran, at the end of the day, the United States had a very different set of priorities with respect to Iran, and Russia and China and the United Nations and the Security Council resolution for sanctions, putting together that coalition and bringing Russia and China along especially turned out to be more important to Washington, more important to Hillary Clinton than the mediating value that Iran and Turkey could have had. I don't want to go into the kind of tick-tock of how the whole crisis unfolded and why.
Sure.
But the aftertaste was in Washington two things. One, a kind of, and it depends on who you're talking about and where they sit. One was, what the hell were the Brazilians doing getting involved in this Iran thing? Why do they have any interest whatsoever? Move over. This is for the big boys at the security table to deal with, and Brazil isn't yet the big boy at the security table. That was one. Two was a kind of more rational notion, which was, you know, the United States actually has a strong interest in negotiations with Iran. And if this can be a confidence building measure put forward by the Brazilian, achieved by the Brazilians and the Turks with that Tehran agreement, why not take advantage of it? Now, that was a minority view and it didn't obviously prevail. But the aftermath was, and I think will be longer term, that Brazil, at great cost to Brazil, demonstrated that the traditional P5 plus one powers aren't the only powers that might have a say or a stake in outcomes in the Middle East. So, you know, you'll hear the Brazilians tell you, Amorim and Patriota will say, we were at Annapolis 1, we're going to be at Annapolis 2. Maybe, just maybe, powers that haven't had a traditional participation in a Middle East peace process might be seen as rational, viable interlocutors. And the truth is, the recognition of the Palestinian state that came last month was, although controversial in some circles up here, also quietly regarded as perhaps a useful, although painful, way of nudging the Israelis forward. So I think the longer term, just to finish this, the longer term thing is going to be maybe a bit like having Brazil in Cancun expand the space for the G20, and down the road by 2007 playing a very positive role in Doha, despite the fact that it didn't pan out. Maybe long term, when we look at this moment 5 years from now, Brazil will, or Turkey, there will be a number of other international players at the Middle East peace table that weren't there before, and perhaps they will help move things along. I mean, I think that that's the emerging power role, is to push open the door, walk in the door, and even if the door slams on your hand, take your licks, but at the end of the day, you're in the room.
That's fascinating, actually, because what you're saying is that if you're sitting in Brasilia, then you did everything correct. I mean,
well, I don't know if everything was done correctly, but go on.
Right. But what follows from your argument, I think, and I believe I agree, is that actually everything's okay. Even if in the aftermath of the Iran situation earlier this year, there was an awful lot of bad blood in Washington with regards to Brazil. And in the press, you know, you had all sorts of views condemning Brazil. The end result hasn't been that bad at all. Because the argument is very much in place that if you want to sort out one of the big problems besetting the world today, the Middle East, then it's legitimate to have other interlocutors. And even if you cannot expect Brazil to follow, but if you know Brazil is not going to follow you all the time, even then, you want to have good dialogue with it. You need to bring it on board somehow. You need to ensure that there is a set of international institutions, formal or informal, that will give countries like Brazil a voice and a seat, because otherwise, it's very difficult to manage the world, as it were.
I think that's right, and I actually...
Is that what you're
saying?
That
is what I'm saying, and I think that, you know, that... I think it is ultimately it legitimizes the United States to be seen as bringing in other powers such as Brazil onto these major issues. Now, we've seen that much more successfully when it comes to not just the United States bringing Brazil in, but Brazil's participation being important and useful and significant. We've seen that already, and with much less controversy on climate change. We've seen it certainly on global financial issues and the expansion of voting rights. It's not been nearly as radioactive, to coin a phrase, when it comes to Iran. But I do think that overall, Matthias, what you're describing is hopefully what we're going to continue to see, anticipating always that there will be misunderstandings, problems, annoyances. Now, the one kind of there are many unknowables about this, but one big unknowable has to do with a very specific domestic political thing here that's happening, which is, you know, we now have a new Congress, and what we've been just describing as a kind of enlightened foreign policy elite view, that of Brazil, that of the United States, and where the convergences and divergences may or may not be, and how to handle them. But we're going to have a Republican-dominated Congress very soon, next week. And there, you know, there's not so much knowledge, and certainly not so much broad-mindedness, a more of an old-school think in the House of Representatives, in the leadership of the Foreign Affairs Committee, where, you know, say Venezuela, say Iran, these ideological hot points – look in the kind of are you with us or are you against us mentality is coming back. And I would not diminish that the effect of that mentality on the kind of instinct of the more rational thinkers of the administration to say and do the right thing. I think it will be...
Excellent. I agree entirely. And I think, I mean, one of the arguments I've been putting forward lately is that that's why it's so important to send the right signals.
Right.
Hillary Clinton coming down to Brasilia for the inauguration, in that sense, is
huge. It's fantastic. It's really very important, and it's a great sign, in fact, that we have gotten over the Iran episode and that she and the president understand that the inauguration is an opportunity to get the two countries back into a better groove.
So, actually, things look quite good because President Dilma is likely to go to the United States at some point early next year, and there's word in town that President Obama will come down to Brazil as well in 2011. And if that were to be the case, then we'd have a pretty good context to make sure that people understand across the ideological spectrum that even if there's an awful lot of disagreement, there's an interest on both sides to keep the ball rolling, and that there is space for diplomatic cooperation. Would you say that's
I would say that's very well said, and I mean, you know, I don't know where the opposition within Brazil is going to come to that kind of dialogue and cooperation with the United States continuing. I'm sure, you know, it will exist internally as it does and will here, but I do think that the signals are incredibly important, and I think also, you know, I think sometimes we as historians, scholars, writers look to the official formal dialogue mechanisms as what they are, official and formal, and not necessarily able to carry the day and resist the political heat that certain moments in time may present. But just to say, there's going to be a political economic dialogue between the two countries at the
sure.
cabinet level going forward in the first part of next year. I understand those to be leading up to potential presidential visits, reinforcing them, and that's all the right thing that ought to be happening. And frankly, you know, realistically speaking, it would be hard to expect more than that. We might see less than that because the relationship will be vulnerable. There might be another coup in Latin America. There might be some international security issue on which Brazil pronounces negatively while it's presiding at the UN Security Council. I mean, many things will mix up this soup. But by and large, I think things are going pretty well.
That's fantastic. Yeah, and it's so strange because at the same time, dialogue is not fluid necessarily, and there aren't many instances where the two countries can actually engage in debate. And yet what we're saying is that the big unspoken assumption here is that lack of knowledge in Washington and minor opposition inside Brazil to doing business with the U.S. actually work in favor of the relationship. And I think that's one of the interesting things about Brazil when we talk about the relationship with the U.S. Even if there are pockets of anti-Americanism here and there, and even if the press play them out big time, truth of the matter is, now you know Brazilian society quite well, this is not an anti-American country in any fundamental way. I wouldn't envisage any Brazilian administration having as much problem as the Chinese government or the Indian government, for that
matter. That's very interesting. I mean, you know, the thing is that Americans are extremely thin-skinned, and they interpret criticism and different policies and different approaches when it comes to a country that is part of Latin America as anti-American. We're able to digest a criticism from China or India or a country that is culturally and geographically distant from us, from Washington, much more readily than we can digest a different policy or a different rhetorical approach by Brazil.
Why is that, though?
I mean,
Abe Lowenthal, back in the 70s, spoke about the hegemonic presumption. Is that what it
well,
is?
What's the hegemonic? Yeah,
what is it?
I mean, it's this kind of weird genetic tick. What can I say? It is this hegemonic presumption, and it shouldn't apply to Brazil. I mean, it shouldn't even apply to the rest of Latin America, but it does. But it's just part of the makeup of the psychology that Brazil needs to anticipate, and that doesn't mean capitulate to, but I think it will be present, that we interpret differentiation as anti-American, and that's why, again, sort of creating some sort of free flow and structure, formal and informal, and connectivity is so important, because the absence is what reinforces those misperceptions. You know, Matthias, I think we need to close the conversation.
Sure. Let's do that. Could I just bring up one last issue? Maybe
yes,
we can talk about it for 2 minutes.
Yes, and I should say to the people that are watching and listening that Matthias's book on the history of Washington and the United States, when Henry Kissinger attempted to bring Brazil into a closer relationship with Washington, is first class, and you should check it out, Kissinger and Brazil.
That's very kind of you, Julia. Excellent. Thanks so much. We're looking forward to reading your book on U.S.-Brazil relations.
No such thing. No such thing. Now, what were you going to
read? The piece in Foreign Affairs is really great, so we look forward to reading more. But just to finish then, one issue that's been huge here in Brazil has been human rights. I mean, on human rights, President Lula took a very traditional stance, based on non-intervention. He's been reluctant to criticize the Cuban regime for human rights abuses, and he's done the same in the case of Iran. Now, this has gotten people both on the right and on the left here in Brazil very upset, and this is one area where possibly we're bound to see some change starting tomorrow. What's your own take on the issue of human rights, given that America's human rights record is so ambiguous as well?
Well, you know, I'm very allergic to the democracy human rights line of criticizing Brazil or Lula. I have to say, precisely because the United States has had such a rough record, you know, typically Democrats, Republicans, Wilsonians, Jacksonians wrap their foreign policies in the flag of democracy and human rights, and that's very, very much mistaken. But having said that, you know, I think it would be just wonderful to have Brazil, to have Dilma Rousseff being more vocal on issues of human rights in Latin America, in Brazil, in the United States, globally. You know, she made it very clear in her initial interview with the Washington Post. She talked about her commitment to human rights, having been the victim of torture when she herself was imprisoned in the 1970s. And I think that, you know, this is a space that is wide open for Brazil, and I would welcome Brazil to step into it. I think that would be a wonderful way of offsetting the skepticism with which Washington is viewed when Washington talks about these issues.
So in principle, if she were to make a statement along those lines when she meets Hillary in the inauguration, when she meets Obama for the first time as president, then we could have a situation in 2011 that is as positive as it was back in 2003 when President Lula met President Bush.
Well, it could be, Matthias, but I don't know if it's like if it's a necessary step that she must take in order to recover that golden moment of 2003. And I also think it would be very important that if human rights does become the subject of a dialogue between the United States and Brazil, that Washington, that Hillary, that Obama doesn't use that opening doesn't make too much of it in a public way. You know, I would much rather see actual cooperation and private discussion on this issue than Washington taking, you know, suddenly saying, look, you know, the new Brazil under Dilma agrees with us and shares our view of how to get things done on that.
That would backfire
big time.
That would
backfire big time. So it would be very important how, if she were to open that door, how Washington then responded.
Excellent. I like that. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you. This has been a total delight. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too.
Enjoy. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye now.